James chapter 1 verses 5 through 11. The second talk in a series on the book of James was presented by Rusty Rexius on May 1, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, we are in our second week of, I think, five for the first rendition or the first rundown in James. I suspect that after 5 weeks at this pace, we might get through two chapters. We'll see. I am endeavoring to get through eight verses today. If I get through those eight, I have nothing prepared beyond that, so we're going to stop. It doesn't really matter what time it will be, but I suspect we'll have enough to fill the hour. The book of James. I won't go through a long review. I will, however, give a few details to bring folks up to speed if they missed last week. I want to make at least three clarifications or corrections before I start, based on a couple of questions that came in. And let me go through the review, and then I'll make a couple of corrections. So this particular letter, if that's what we want to call it, is written by James, obviously. The conclusion that I've come to is this is James, the brother of Jesus, who was also the brother of Jude, the author of Jude. This is the same James who we know, historically speaking, was the head of the Jerusalem church. It dawned on me, I've thought about this before, but it sort of struck me, those Jews that were living in Jerusalem under the direction and guidance of James were arguably the first Messianic Jews, which I never really thought of it those terms before. So we have James, the head of the Messianic Jewish Church of Jerusalem. They probably didn't have a sign out front with respect to that. This is one of the clarifications I want to make. I'm arguing, and it's not a very strong argument for what it's worth, that the letter was written in or around 60 AD. There are two schools of thought. Well, there's a whole lot of schools of thought. The lot of schools of thought land in one of two places. Either James was written very early, arguably the earliest of all of the New Testament letters, 40-something or later, somewhere around 60 AD. I said that James was written before Romans, which is not what I intended to say. What I meant to say was James was written before Romans made its way around the ancient Near East. I don't know how accurate this is, but from what I have read, Romans went into circulation around 90 AD, meaning that it became well known, everybody had their copy of it. That's after what I'm suggesting that James wrote the letter in 60 AD. I won't go through the reasons why. I will tell you I'm not particularly bent on this perspective. If it's 40, that's fine. If it's 60, that's fine too. I think there's some good reason for it being 60. I did sort of realize this week as I was studying and reading a little bit, I'm not really a history buff. My son is. I'm not. So I'm really at the mercy of what other people are saying about things like when was the book written and who wrote it. And that's somewhat of an uncomfortable position for me. I've always taken the stance with respect to the exegesis of this stuff that with enough skill and a little bit of reason, I can work my way through, at least I think I can work my way through what an author is trying to communicate. I'm sort of stuck when it's when was something written and why was it written without having the evidence directly given to me from the Bible. So that's why I read a little bit, I weigh the arguments, I land on one, not exactly sure that I'm convinced beyond any shadow or reasonable doubt that I'm right about that. I'm going to go with it for right now. I'm going to say it was written in 60 AD. If it's 40, fine. It was written to Jewish people, for sure. We learned that from the first verse. It was written to not a particular group of Jewish people, but a plethora of Jews that were spread around after the diaspora, or diaspora, depending on how you want to say that. I don't know that even when James, or we'll talk about this in a minute, his disciples wrote this thing, that he actually had anybody particular in mind. I suspect that he knew from reports that he'd gotten that life was hard for the Jewish people all over the world after the persecution of Stephen and the pushing out from Jerusalem, and for that matter, Israel in general, the Jews all over the world. It was not an easy thing to be a Jew, and James knew that. Certainly was not an easy thing to be a Jew in Jerusalem or in Israel itself, and it wasn't an easy thing to be a Jew anywhere else in the world. And so James and or his disciples were well aware of that, and so this letter is written in response to the difficult life that a Jewish person was living in that particular time. While there, I don't think there was anything specific that he was thinking, there were a number of occasions that I think he was writing into. Things that he knew were going on, not particular incidences, but things in general that he knew were going on that he was writing into. He knew at the time that it was a costly thing to be a Jew, and he was writing to encourage those folks to stick, well, a believing Jew. It was hard to be a Jew in general, some places, but a believing Jew, and he was writing to encourage them to not give up, not quit pursuing the faith. There are at least two theories, probably more, on the structure of James. Well, not the structure. Well, yeah, the structure of James, or why he wrote, or how he wrote. One of them argues that James is following the approximately the Sermon on the Mount. He's picking off some of the things that Jesus said, and he's elaborating on those things. I read a few verses last week. I won't do that this week. That's an interesting argument. There are a number of similarities for sure. There's a lot of things that James says that Jesus said. That probably shouldn't surprise us. James was his brother, and while not one of the traveling disciples, somewhere along the way he got to spend some time with Jesus and certainly would have been familiar with what he had to say. So the argument is that James is elaborating on words of Jesus, in particular the Sermon on the Mount. Could be. Another interesting theory, and the one that I'm attracted to, and I'm not convinced it's right either, but I'm attracted to it, that there was something in the time called a Yalkut or a Yulkut, and it was a compilation of writings of a particular rabbi or preacher, if you want to use that term. And you're familiar with that kind of thing, that a rabbi had a number of people who were under his teaching, and he would teach, typically on Sabbath, the evening of, and then throughout the week he would teach as well on whatever that particular weekly teaching was. There were a number of occasions when his disciples, any of the rabbis, would compile those teachings and create something called this Yalkut, which was a compilation of a number of his sermons or thoughts. The theory is that this is one of those things that James's disciples put together specifically with respect to James's teaching on Leviticus 19 and the first half of 20. I don't know if any of you took the time to read that, but there are a number of things in that particular passage. That's a weekly Torah reading. I don't remember, it didn't bring those notes, what it's called, but it's one of the specific weekly Torah readings that has been read all over the world for millennia now. That particular one, read on a Friday. The following week, the argument goes is that James was teaching on that section of Leviticus, and that his disciples recorded those teachings, made what we have as the book of James, to send off to the folks that were in need of some encouragement. If you read Leviticus, and I took the time to take the comparison and read James and read Leviticus, first of all, the way that James goes about things and the way that Leviticus goes about things, they're not in the same order. So it's not as though you could look at Leviticus and look at James and go, yep, they're talking about the same thing. You got to bounce around a little bit. But if you bounce around a little bit, you'll find a number of similarities. I have no doubt, none whatsoever, and this is one of the things I mentioned last week, that whatever James was doing, he was speaking of Torah. No doubt about that. Any rabbi, whoever they were in that particular time, I would argue whatever they happened to be saying was in regards and in reflection with Torah. That's what they lived by. That's what mattered to them. That's what ultimately was driving their life and their thought. And so any thoughts that James or Peter or John or anybody else would have Torah in the background. So whether Leviticus or not, James is certainly speaking with Torah in the background, for sure, I think. Which makes for an interesting challenge for us. Well, I'm Jewish, you're not. So for you, it's hard because it's not written to you. And, okay, now let me jump off of that for a minute. It is a bit of a mind game we have to play because we're reading a Jewish author writing to a Jewish audience in a Jewish place in a Jewish time with Jewish thought, and we're bouncing in on that, trying to figure out what in the world that means to us. Well, it does mean something to us, but it means something to us in the context of the Jewish world and way in which it was written. So we have to do a little work to try to remember, well, it's not us that he's speaking to, and it's not the Jewish situation that we're living in, but what he's saying is true nonetheless, and so we need to apply it to our lives to the extent that it's just true, not necessarily just Jewish. And that's sometimes tricky, or at least I think it's tricky, and I have to remind myself over and over again that James isn't actually writing to me, nor was he speaking to me. Torah was written and was meant for the Jews, but what's true of Torah is true for all of us. I think that that's just true. I summed up the first four verses of James like this. Certainly more that can be said. The life of an authentic believer will include circumstances and situations authored by God himself that will ask you a question. As I face into whatever God has drawn up for my life, am I committed or not to the belief that God is in fact good and he is the rewarder of those who pursue him? That, I think, is in general what James is addressing in the first four verses. We stopped at verse 4. We'll go to verse 5. I think I mentioned before, this is my second clarification I'd like to make. Yeah, I have one other one I need to remember to make. The second clarification is James, undoubtedly, if you've read it, you know, is not a typical sort of here's the argument and here's the structure, let's figure that out kind of letter or book. It feels like it's just sort of these random thoughts, these random ideas. I don't think it's random. I don't just think it's a bunch of ideas or good things put down on a piece of paper in some mishmash of just good stuff. There is a reason and a rhyme and a reason behind it, and there is a structure to it. It's a little hard to figure that out. But there is one. And one of the things that I'll say today is that the first structure that I notice is that at least these first eight verses are James speaking to something very specifically, and then first 12 verses, and then he moves on to something a little bit different. So there is a structure. We'll hopefully figure out more as we go through. I'm still working on that, frankly. I'm not sure that I've got it completely figured out. And I already mentioned the second clarification now that I think about it. I erroneously sort of threw out there that James was written to the folks after the sacking of Jerusalem in 70 AD. It wasn't. It was the Jews being chased out after the persecution and martyrdom of Stephen that I think is the timing of why they were out and about in the rest of the world. So I'm going to put on my readers. I didn't print out for myself these eight verses on a sheet, so I'm going to read it out of the Bible here so we can get this part on the record. This is not my translation. This is New American Standard, but I'm not too far off, I don't think. Starting in verse 5, "But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach. It will be given to him. But let him ask in faith without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. But let the brother of humble circumstances glory in his high position, and let the rich man glory in his humiliation, because like a flowering grass he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and the flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away." I don't know, for those of you who have ever done any teaching, how often you have found that when you're talking about something or thinking through something, that something becomes relevant in your life that week. Amazing how that works. And as it happens, this was something that I was bumping into all week as I was thinking about this stuff. I'll talk a little bit about that maybe later. I'm going to do what I said before. This is going to feel way more like a Bible study than it is a sermon. I'm going to go down and I'm just going to parse this stuff and tell you what I think is going on. I hope that that's not terribly boring to you. I'll throw in a few sermonettes, if you will, along the way. But this is, like I said, this will feel very much more like a Bible study. So, but if any of you is deficient in wisdom, the but if, I mean, obviously the but if suggests that there's something that he's going to contrast. If you are working through in your life, you've bumped into a trial, that test of your faith, and you're wondering whether you ought to pursue what you have said you believe is true or not. If you are deficient in wisdom, if you lack the ability to discern whether or not you should take the step forward in faith or not, if any of you is deficient in wisdom, he should ask from God. I think it's important to recognize that what we're talking about here is specifically if we are deficient in wisdom. I have decided that wisdom, I mean, there's a million different variations and definitions of what that means, but I've equated it to eyes to see and ears to hear. That is what I think wisdom actually is. So when one is faith, now remember, James speaking to a troubled audience in and around the ancient Near East, facing into a struggle of life and wondering if that struggle, specifically because they're a believer, is worth it or not to continue on. So the question he's asked, if you don't know whether it's worth it or not, then ask God for clarity on that. I think that's the wisdom in which he is referring to. If you're unsure, you're unclear, you're uncertain, then ask God if he will give you that wisdom. Eyes to see and ears to hear. This is wisdom that is specifically about tests of faith or your commitment and how one should respond to them. What I don't think this is wisdom about circumstances and events in life. What I don't think this is where should I go to school or who should I marry or what car should I buy or what job should I take? All those are legitimate questions and I guess arguably require wisdom to come up with the right answer, but that's not what James is talking about. And I suspect you already know that. This is the wisdom with respect to how I see what I'm facing and how I'm going to relate to that in view of my belief of God and me and how that's supposed to play itself out. That's the wisdom. I think it's important to remember that that's the wisdom, because that's the wisdom that any of us who is looking for clarity in what we believe, that's what we want, don't we? Don't you want to know whether or not what you believe is true and if you ought to pursue it or not in light of the circumstances that you face? That makes sense to me. It also is important, I think. He says right after, if you're deficient in wisdom, he should ask from God. I'll talk about in a minute the one giving to all generously and without revile, and it shall be given to him. I think that's the only way, that's the only kind of wisdom that James or anybody else could ever say and promise and guarantee that God will answer. There is no other sort of wisdom that one could ensure himself by asking God would give. But a heart that wants to know what's right, God promises, James says, he'll give them the understanding, that kind of wisdom. I probably should mention, he notes that you should ask God for wisdom. I suppose there are ways you could think of asking somebody else or something else for wisdom, but James makes it clear, ask God. He also says he's the one who gives generously and without revile. And I looked up that word revile, try to figure out what exactly he means there, and I think what James is getting at is there's nothing certainly wrong or even embarrassing, or God is not miffed when we are not clear about whether we should push on or not. That's not problematic to God. He looks at those questions, according to James, and there is no punishment, there is no persecution, there is no reaction from God in a negative way for one who simply asks, I am deficient in wisdom, I wish I had it, could I have it? I'm glad for that, because I am regularly lacking in wisdom, wondering if I should pursue what I say I believe, and thankfully God does not offer retribution for such a thing. James is reminding through this particular statement that when one is unconvinced, shaky, or teetering, what does one do? He asks for God to shore up his mind and clear up his heart. It's precisely the wisdom that James is speaking of. Seems to me that when we look at the example that James doesn't give, I know he knew of the example of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane as being one of those places where this wisdom, I think, was asked for on the part of Jesus. Certainly a temptation, a trial was before him. We don't have we have a record of the prayer. I suspect there's probably more that Jesus said than what was recorded, but it seems to me that Jesus is asking God for wisdom, clarity about whether or not, in light of what he knew was coming before him, his belief, should he move forward or not? Should he take the next step and fulfill his mission as Messiah or not? And I think it's clear that Jesus needed clarity on that. Jesus needed wisdom, which is an odd thing to think about. Jesus needed wisdom, and I think he did need wisdom. I think he's asking for wisdom. Whether he would have ultimately not done it, I don't know, and we never will know, but it appears to me that he certainly had this question about whether or not he should move forward exactly the way that I would have that question, ask God for wisdom, and God clearly gave it to him. In the work of completing his telos, that is Jesus' telos, there arose a question as a result of his circumstances to which he asked God for clarity, wisdom. He asked God to filter his heart. God did exactly that, and Jesus completed his work, his finished work, his telos. Seems to me that's how we're supposed to approach life. I dawned on something this week, though, that I had to sort of think through, and I have two little sermonettes. I told you I'd have two, and I'm going to read them. There's a difference between me and Jesus. You're shocked by that, I know. My family is especially shocked by that statement. The telos that Jesus, ultimately, I guess it's the same. It's fulfilling that God-given mission that each of us has, me and Jesus. But Jesus's telos was to be king in a kingdom. Ultimately, that was his role. He was going and is going to be king in a kingdom. Well, unless I'm missing something, I don't get to be a king in a kingdom. And I don't think you do either. What is up for grabs, if you will, for me and for you, is mercy and a place in the kingdom. That's different. Jesus didn't need mercy. I need mercy. So when I'm asking for wisdom and Jesus is asking for wisdom, there is a slight difference in how it is we're thinking about what our end is. So let me read something that came to me as a result, actually, of our Roman study on Monday night, a reminder from our Roman study I wrote. There are so many things in this life that come up and can and do create controversy, confusion, or in anything but clarity with respect to how I am to interact with the broken world that I live in. Even as I contemplate the circumstances and issues that arise in my life that can and do call into question what I actually believe and understand that God has put them there for me, I am a broken, sinful, and devious man. I can and I do gain moments of perspective, clarity, and even wisdom, but ultimately that is short-lived, only to remind me again that the fundamental and ongoing need I have is for mercy. No matter how many times I come up to the right perspective of what life is really all about, I remain a man who is fundamentally selfish, self-centered, and evil. As such, the wisdom I ultimately need is the knowledge that Jesus will be my advocate. Not because I figured out the right things to believe about the world around me in which I live, but rather I continue to figure out what is wrong with me and my ongoing need for him to come to my rescue. That's a little different problem than Jesus had. So while I think there is great value in comparing and contrasting this challenge and the response that Jesus had and the temptations and trials that he faced, it wouldn't be honest to say that it's exactly the same. Because Jesus wasn't broken. And so the wisdom that I need and the perspective that I have towards that wisdom is slightly different. A second ponder that I had for the week. And this is a little longer, so last thing I will just read. I have been thinking about that my test is akin to the test that Jesus had to endure. And at one level, I do think that's right. We both have been made promises by God, and if we choose, then endure the course that God has had set before us to receive those promises, he will grant us our reward. Jesus is king, me a place in that kingdom. But there is a difference that I think is worthy of note and has begun to influence how I am thinking about all of this. Jesus was not a broken man. He was not, at the core of his soul, a fundamentally selfish, self-centered, self-absorbed human. While human, he was a righteous human, with built-in eyes to see and ears to hear. I am not. The question Jesus had to answer was, will I endure what God has set before me in order that I might fulfill and enjoy my role as Messiah? Of course, his answer was yes, although I believe he wondered. My question is a little different. It is still, will I endure for the promises set before me, but the obstacles are very different for me. I am broken and deprived. I will not always choose right over wrong. I will not always find the promises of God more important than my own wants and desires. While I may stay the course of the pursuit of all things God, I will do so in a way very much not like what Jesus did. Ultimately, I wonder if the test, the one that I've been talking about, is not so much that I will endure what God has set before me, that is certainly on the table, but in a much deeper and more profound way, what will I do with the harsh reality that I keep finding myself broken, terribly, terribly broken, in spite of my pursuit? Is the question not so much, will I continue to believe, but rather, what will I do with my messed up life? I need mercy over and over and over again. And it seems to me, when I was thinking about that this week, the whole rubber meeting the road thing, I made the claim that James tends to be the how then shall we live sort of book. It's easy to say when we face into temptations or a trial that I'll come out of that still believing. And I've done that before. I'm sure you have too. A couple of very specific occasions that I recall when I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know how I would respond to what God had set before me. But I came out the other end still believing. But then it's like, well, that now what? I mean, I'm still believing, but what do I do? How do I respond and react and live? And it just seems to me that at the end of the day, what I keep coming back to over and over again, especially as I'm interacting with other people, is how am I thinking about what I ultimately and really need? Mercy from God. That is what I need, and that is what I want. Last comment about this. I have been thinking about this question of trials, and I think I've got them now into three stages, but Jesus only had two. The first question that I have to answer is, God is the author of all reality, and the story will be told, every jot and tittle of it, precisely as he sees fit. Will I accept that? That's question one. Question number two, my story is authored by God, and my job is not so much to figure out the story, and certainly not, I'm not going to be the one to create it, but rather I need to rightly respond to the story that God has written. Will I do that? That's question number two. Number three, the story is told, I think, with one primary goal in mind, to reveal my need for mercy and the profound, amazing, and incredible way in which God has answered that need by, quote-unquote, simply sending Jesus to tell his story in order that my story might be told. What will I do with that? That's the one that Jesus didn't have to figure out. I do. So do you. I may come back and say something about the Lord's Prayer, but I might not. I'm going to save that for later. We'll see if I have time for that. Okay. That's sort of a rewind back to this question around what exactly is this trial or temptation that James is talking about that his audience and ourselves are facing into. And when you're facing into it, what do you do when you're not sure what to do? Ask for wisdom and he'll give it to him. He'll give it to him without revile. I just noticed there were three places where that word was used, all three in Matthew, so that you know what it is not the case that God would do when one asks for wisdom because they don't have it. Blessed are you when people insult you, that's the word insult you, and persecute you and say all kinds of evil things about you falsely on account of me. So insult is the operative word there. That's not what God will do if we ask for wisdom because we lack it. Number two, then Jesus began to criticize, that's the word, criticize openly the cities in which he had done many of his miracles because they did not repent. And three, the robbers who were crucified with him also spoke abusively. That's the other thing that God won't do when we ask for wisdom because we lack it. And he gives generously, it says. Verse 6, but he must ask in belief without discriminating. For the one discriminating is like rough water of the sea, having been driven and tossed about by the wind. I think this is a fascinating verse. It's incredibly relevant because I've lived it, it seems to me, in most of my life. If you're asking for wisdom, if you're asking for God to open your eyes, give you eyes to see and ears to hear, if you really want that, what James is saying is you can't go at that half-heartedly. You must ask in belief. I mean, it sounds like I translated that. I didn't. It's this little funny little preposition, N-E-N, in belief. What I don't think this means is that you ask God with your eyes closed super tightly together and your fists super, 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 super clenched, and you really, 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 really believe that God is going to do something. That may be a good thing to do, and if you do that, that's fine, but I don't think that's what James is talking about. I think this in belief is something along the lines of asking for this wisdom with an all-in attitude of belief. In other words, I'm asking, and whatever I might find, I'm in. That's what I think he means by in belief, by belief, with belief, something along those lines. In other words, what God elects for me, for the wisdom that I seek, that is what I desire, whatever it takes. If I lack wisdom and I ask God for it, whatever he conjures up that's going to provide the wisdom that I seek, I'm in. I'll take it. As difficult and as uncomfortable as that might well be. And I assume we've all had that moment. Well, I can't assume. I will tell you, I have had the moment over and over and over again saying those prayers. God, whatever you think I need. And then you just sort of wait. Because it just doesn't feel like it's ever going to be good, which is so warped. Because it ultimately always is good. But the trouble is that he knows what we need and we don't know what we need. I assume, as I said, we've all had that moment of wonder, am I truly okay with whatever God is going to serve up? Truly learning who we are and what we're up against is not easy, it's not simple, and it's not painless. I began to wonder if this is not what suffering is. I don't know. It's not all that suffering is, but there is a sense in which that response that God gives, the one that is incredibly uncomfortable because it's what we need, if that is not what suffering is. He says that we're to ask and believe without discriminating. This is fascinating. Discriminating, as I have defined it, is withholding judgment on what God determines to decide if we like it or not. And we've all, okay, I'll stop that. I have done that. I don't know whether you have or not. But I have said so many times to myself, I am fine, God, whatever it takes and whatever I need is just swell, as long as I like it. And I just think we've all been there where we want to withhold judgment. So it is our discriminating with God. It is our looking at what God has decided is in line for our teaching, and we're making the decision whether that is what we ought to go with or not. That is what discrimination is. Four places where I found that word, which I think is helpful, Matthew and 3 and Acts. Matthew says, and in the morning it will be stormy. This is a quote. It will be stormy today because the sky is red and darkening. You know how to judge, that's the word, correctly the appearance of the sky, but cannot evaluate the signs of the time. Second place, but get out of Acts, get up and go down and accompany them without hesitation because I have sent them. Hesitation is the word, which is just super helpful right there. Third one, so when Peter went up to Jerusalem, the circumcised believers took issue with him. Taking issue with what God has served up for us. Again, very relevant. And last, he made no distinction between them and us, cleansing our hearts by faith. It is this distinction between what's best for me and what's not so best for me based on my decisions rather than God's. There is no measuring, I have noted, no measuring God's prerogative and deciding what one thinks about that. At least there's no such thing that exists in the child of God. I wonder if the person who is the discriminator of God's doings is the person who is lukewarm, the person who is not quite all the way there, sort of in, sort of out. I'm going to wait and see how this goes. And we all know what happens with the person who's lukewarm. The next part of that verse, the churning water, keep putting this behind me here, the one discriminating is like the rough water of the sea having been driven and tossed about by the wind. Incredibly illustrative. The one who is unsure and unclear and uncertain about how one is going to take God's advice, for lack of a better term there, is exactly like the water that churns. You've all been to Devil's Churn, isn't that the one on the Oregon coast, or Devil's Elbow or one of those, and if you haven't been there, you've been somewhere where you've seen, watched, and the water churns and bashes, and it goes in, it goes out, it's got absolutely no direction, it's got no boundaries, it's got nothing hemming it in. It is a wild mess of chaos, which James is pointing out that the person who is unsure of their commitment to whatever God has in mind is exactly like that kind of water. Just everywhere, all over the place, with no end, no start, no up, no down, chaos. Chaos. I hadn't thought about this, but I wonder if it's better to just simply reject the advice than to do the back and forth thing. I don't know. It's probably less chaotic. The couple of friends that I've had who have just decided to bolt the faith said never have they felt better when they just decided they're out. Why? Because they didn't have that turmoil anymore. They weren't doing the churn of the water because they weren't sure whether they were in or out. It's not easy when you're in, but it's not like the water. It's not the churn. It's not the limitless chaos. Verse 7, for that man must not suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. Well, remember, it's not the red Corvette or the nice big boat or the new home that one is asking for that he's not going to receive. He probably won't receive that either, but he's not going to receive the wisdom that he asked for. He's not going to receive that confidence, ultimately those eyes to see and ears to hear as to whether or not this thing that he says he believes and wants to pursue, ultimately leading with mercy, he won't get that. She won't get that. God is not in the business of granting what they're asking for if they're not in, like he says, in belief. He's very clear. God's just not going to give him that. He must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. I don't think that's very confusing. I think that's actually somewhat logical. It's like, yeah, well, if you're not in, you're not getting what you're asking for. I'll leave it at that. Verse 8, he is a double-minded, hesitant man, unstable and restless in all his ways. He wants wisdom, but he also wants what he wants. And I wonder if this can be related to serving two masters. If the one who is double-minded, who is not clear whether or not he wants what God has prepared for him to give him the wisdom that he seeks, if that is not the person who is settled with two masters, whether that's money or not, we'll talk about money in a minute here, but he's serving his own creativeness as the creator and God as the creator. There are two masters there, and he's not sure which one is the one he'll follow. Unstable and restless. Actually, I've inserted restless in all of his ways. No confidence, no certainty, no direction, wandering. Seems very clear. Double-minded man is that one who is claiming and even wanting to be a servant of God and yet also being torn by the desire we all have to write our own story. What will set my course? The question we must all ask. I thought of that passage and I actually copied it here. It's not exactly the same thing, but the one who was unstable, restless in his ways. I thought of the old song, when the rains came down, the floods came up, and the house on the rock stood firm. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them is like the wise man who built his house on a rock. The rain fell and the flood came and the winds beat against the house, but it did not collapse because it had been founded on rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell and the flood came up, and the winds had begun to beat the house, and it collapsed. It was utterly destroyed. It's not exactly the same thing, but that reminds me of the person who is unstable in his ways. He collapses, and he ends up getting washed out to sea. Okay, now I think James does it. I think it's an interesting, I don't know if it's a strategy or not, but I'm assuming what happens here is James has just spent those opening eight verses, describing a circumstance and a situation broadly that his audience, his Jewish fellow believing Jews all over the known world are facing into. He knows it. He's dealing with it in Jerusalem. There's certainly persecution going on there. There's absolutely problems that the Messianic community was facing in Jerusalem, maybe more so than any place else in the world. And he knew that was the case for everybody who was living this life of a Jesus-believing Jew. So whether he'd heard about a situation out and about, or whether he's just looking across the street or next door where he's at, I think he picks a situation or a circumstance that he knows everybody can relate to. And it's the whole question that gets asked here about financial well-being. At least I think that's what it is. Now, I'm going to just go ahead and admit, I went through this book 2 or 3 years ago, first time I translated it, and I fought like crazy to make this section be not about money. I wanted it to be about, when we'll get to these words in a minute, well, let me just read them. Now, the humble brother should take pride in his high station or his high rank, but the one of means in his humble state, because like a flower of grass, it will fade away. For the sun rises up with heat, and the grass and the flower dry up, and the appearance of its beauty is lost. In this manner also the rich in his way of life will fade away. And I really wanted that to be about something more along the lines of the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit. And it's true, you can go and you can make that case here, and it is true that that's a good thing. Blessed are the poor in spirit. That's true. And we could talk about that, and that would be beneficial. And the opposite of being poor in spirit, the haughty of mind, that's bad. And we could talk about that too. That would be right to think about those things. But for me anyway, it breaks down here. So I actually am right now thinking that this actually has to do with money. And this is one of those places where, as I mentioned a minute ago, the whole rubber meeting the road thing. I'm not going to tell all sorts of personal stories, at least I don't think I am, but I will tell you that the notion of money and what to do with it has been a lifelong question of mine and frankly, my family. And I don't think I'm saying anything that most of you wouldn't already know. Our family has not been in want for a few generations. We're no Donald Trump, I can tell you that, financially speaking or otherwise. But it's not like money has been, well, I will tell you a story in a minute. We haven't not had. And my dad spent so much time talking to us about what that meant and why and what to do with your money. And I still have it. When I first started working, we tithed. That's what you do when you have money, is whether you have money or not, you tithe. But when I started working, my dad set me down and we talked through how I was going to go ahead and tithe. And so I have a handwritten notebook when I started working that I would write every 2 weeks when we got paid. But I'd go ahead and every day I worked, I would write down the hours I worked. I think I started at $2.70 and then minus 10%. And then how much I made minus taxes, which were less than they are now. And then this is how much I actually had, which I was, by the way, working to buy a car. But my dad, the whole tithing thing and what you did with your money, but more importantly, why you had money and all, it was a regular subject in our family. And yet I read something like this, as I've read it many, many times, the way that this ends, "For in this manner also the rich in his way of life will fade away." That's hard to read. Not because I feel like I'm rich, but because I don't feel like I'm one of humble means, meaning financially speaking. So this becomes very personal for me, and it always has been. I suspect it always will be. I mean, I've worked through that for the most part, I think, and I'll talk about that a little bit here. But in any case, I just put out there that the issues around money, rarely do people talk about. People talk about all the time what you do when you're poor and how you should be thinking about that from a believer standpoint, but it's not often people talk about what you do when you're not poor from a believer standpoint, other than give a bunch of it away. Well, that's fine, but how should I think about the fact that I have money? How should I process that in light of what the Bible says about money? How should I think about what I should do tomorrow and the next day with whatever money I have, other than just tithe like a good boy? Those are live questions for me. Okay. The humble brother should take pride in his high rank. There are lots of places where this word humble is used, and frankly, most of them are more akin to the notion of humble with respect to your position in life, not money so much, your spirit, that kind of humility. Something humble, lowly position, lowly, downtrodden. Several of those things talk about those who are downtrodden. Again, James speaks to the humble in chapter 4, which we'll get there sometime in 2021. But he gives greater grace, therefore it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Well, that sounds a lot more like not so much money, but the other kind of notion around humility. But if you notice what he says in verse 9 and 10, which we just read, but the one of means takes pride, or something along those lines, in his humble state, because like for a flower of grass, it will fade away. For the sun rises up with heat, and the grass and its flower dry up, and the appearance of the beauty is lost. In this manner, the rich in his way of life will fade away. So the contrast that he's bringing up is there's the one of humble means, and then there's the one who has. So it seems to me that he's comparing two sets of people, people who have money or some kind of wealth, and those that don't. So you have to stop for a minute and say, well, what's he getting at here? What's James driving at? Well, I'm assuming, and now I have to do a little filling in the blanks from other places in the Bible and other, I think, readings that are legit in terms of what was going on. When the Jews were booted out of Jerusalem, or left Jerusalem, I guess not booted out, left Jerusalem, there was a clear persecution of the believing Jews who were in and amongst the non-believing Jews. There are places that it appears that Jewish people who were not believers, not only did they persecute in terms of ridiculing and all that goes along with that kind of persecution of the believing Jews, but they were taking their stuff. They were not giving them jobs. They were forcing them out of their homes. They were, I don't know how it worked with their kids, but their kids were suffering. I mean, there was a financial cost to being a believing Jew. So my assumption here is that James is speaking specifically to those people, that it is not just anybody who doesn't have any money, although I suppose that could be the case, but rather he is speaking to his audience who doesn't have what they don't have because they believe. So he's saying, as an example, you out there, if your test is that you have been, what has been yours was extracted from you because of your belief, what should you do about that? And James says, you should take pride in that high position. And I think all he means by that is that you should be thankful that you have suffered because of what you believe. And there is something very lofty in that. There is something very good about that. There is something very right about that. The reason you don't have is not because God has not given it to you per se, but it is rather because it's been taken because of what you believe. There is something very right about that from your perspective. And then I think he says, and by the way, if you look across the street at the one who just took what was yours and now has and you don't, that's the one of means. But the one of means, I don't know exactly what to do with should boast or take pride or whatever in his humble state. But the fact of the matter is he is in a humble state because what he has, what he's taken, what he has extracted, that's like a flower of grass. It'll fade away. What he has is not lasting. What he has decided is important is not eternal. It is merely temporary. It has given him a perspective and a reality of life that he can look at today and be glad in it, but he can't be glad in it forever. You can. He says in verse 11, "For the sun rises up with heat, and the grass and its flower dry up, and the appearance of its beauty is lost. In this manner also the rich in his way of undertakings, his way of life or his undertakings will fade away." This is where I have to take some license, but I don't think it's an illegal license. It seems to me that the rich in his way of life, what he's speaking to is those rich people in their way of life. It's not a blanket statement. It makes no sense to be a blanket statement. I listed a whole bunch of rich people in the Bible who this would make no sense, starting with Abraham. Well, actually starting with Job, because I think he was before Abraham. Job took it in the shorts, to be sure, but he was a very wealthy man and got it all back. So there certainly could be nothing wrong with the riches in and of themselves. Abraham, arguably one of the richest men in the land. I don't think he ever got criticized for that. What about David? What about Solomon? Although they had their troubles, it wasn't their wealth that they were knocked for. It was the rest of their life that they had been messed up in. What about Lydia, the lady that was the helper of Paul in Philippi, if I remember right? Rich lady. So, and I could go on and on. So it doesn't appear that what James is speaking to, he is speaking to money. I do think that could be wrong, could be convinced otherwise. Somebody can do that if they'd like. But he is speaking to money. But he's speaking to money that has been, there is a reason for the money that they have, and the reason was wrong, and as a result, the beauty of that will be lost. The beauty of the one who has had it taken for the sake of what he believes, that's a very, very high and lofty place to be, because you've stood firm in what you believe in spite of what you want to do and go get what that guy has, because it's mine, and I want it back. So I think what James is doing here for us is nothing more and nothing less than using a specific example of folks who do not have financial wealth because it has been taken from them on the basis and for the reason of their belief by people who have unjustly grabbed and have found their riches. The contrast is there. And he's saying, don't bail because your financial wherewithal has been taken. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. They've got it. It'll all fade away. What you have is eternal. I do, in 3 minutes, want to take one step outside of the text, a little bit outside of the text, and make a couple of comments on the whole money thing, too. Because, again, I've thought a lot about this, and there seems to be little doubt to me that there's no little doubt. There are all sorts of warnings about what money can do and the reasons for it, to beware of it. And I think that all of those are absolutely legitimate. But it seems to me this isn't the fundamental issue. That ultimately what it comes down to is what place the money or whatever else it is playing in your life. Isn't it come down to if at the end of the day, if what you're doing and what you are pursuing is specifically in order that you get more stuff, as over against the pursuit of what's true. In other words, you've rejected the pursuit of truth in order to get more stuff. Isn't that what's at issue? Isn't that what's the matter with the money? Isn't that what's the matter with wealth and riches? That you have the stuff is not the problem. It is certainly true that once you have it, what you do with it is indicative and telling about where your heart is. But that you have it is not the problem. It's probably how you got it and why you think you have it. when we were young and my dad was telling the many stories about money and how we should think about it, my dad was convinced that tomorrow it would all go away. Because my dad believed, and I think he was right, that God had given us what God had given us for his own reason, and tomorrow it was his right to take it away. If he wanted to, he could, and if he did, that would be fine, and that was the way we should be glad in that. But my dad got a little bit whacked out about that because he not only knew that God could take it away, he was convinced that he was going to take it away, so we were always preparing for that. And I'll never forget one night, Dad came home, we sat on the dinner table, said, "Carolyn, we need to start drinking powdered milk." We're all like, "What?" "Yep, pretty sure it's all going down the toilet, and it's cheaper to do powdered milk, so we're going to start drinking powdered milk because it's all going to go." We did buy powdered milk, and it was awful, and it didn't all go, so we got to go back to regular milk. But my dad's perspective was, I'm thankful for this for my life, that God gave us what he gave us simply because he chose to. That was it. And we better not lose perspective on that, that it is a gift, it is only a gift, and it is a gift that God may take back. So do well with it while you have it, meaning do the right thing with it. There was another perspective that I heard that was slightly different and I think horribly wrong. God gave us what we have because we're good people. And I still hear that. And it makes me shudder because it's so not true. It's never true, ever, because there's no such thing as a good person. So one never has because one is good. One only has because it is a gift. And the person that thinks one has because one is good has got a terrible, terrible thing awaiting. They're going to be really surprised, really surprised. 8 minutes. Questions?
Thanks, Rusty. I have a suggestion for how to understand those verses about the humble brother and the brother of means, or the one of means and stuff, that I'd like to hear what you think about it. What if both of the people, the poor man and the rich man, are both brothers? They're both Christians. And so what James would be saying is, if you find yourself in being a poor Christian, this you would not expect this, but you should boast in that fact because you are either, like you suggested, you are being persecuted and there's something honorable about that because of the cause, or, and that makes sense. Let's just stop with that. But if you find yourself a Christian of means, you'd expect that from somebody to say, well, take pride in that. But no, he flips it around and says, you should take pride in the fact that it's not what you should take pride in, if that makes sense. Like, and so he's trying to point their priority to, don't let that be what you take pride in, because it's all going to pass away, like you just expressed. And this reminds me a lot of Ecclesiastes, and that sentiment is there as well. And so then he goes on, and when he has the picture about the scorching heat and the plant, he's like, if you're not convinced, let me. Well, this is why you should not take pride in your money, because it's all going to go away. And your riches, if you're a rich man, like your richness is going to fade away while you're still working for it or something like that. So what do you think about that?
Well, I actually went there for a while, and I think you can make that work, and that makes some sense. What tripped me up was at the very end of that, when it just sounds in 10 and 11 like it's more than just, like something bad happens. Maybe I'm overreacting to the flower fading and grass getting withered, and I mean, I've translated it in the manner also in which, in this manner also, the rich in his way of life or his undertakings will fade away. It doesn't say that he'll die and go away as a non-believer, but it kind of seems more like it's a not-so-good situation. And so I may have overreacted to that, and if I did, then I like your suggestion, and I actually have a bunch of notes here that are crossed out that actually say just that. Okay. But I went the other direction.
Okay, that makes sense.
But thank you. I like that.
I like what you said, Karina, particularly on verse 9. Flowed really well with the previous part of the passage. I kind of had a different interpretation of how those two fit together, particularly because it talks about the humble brother having a high position, and I was trying to think of what that high position was, and it occurred to me that as children of God and people destined for eternal life, we get a high position, and that we can take pride in that and boast in that. And how the high position and the low position, are they the same position that both the humble and the rich man are taking? And I think probably is. At least that's the way that I'd take it. And how is that a low position for a rich man? Well, it's because the rich man must realize that he's not the one taking care of himself, that his riches are not what's going to keep him prosperous and doing well. And he has to acknowledge the fact that he is under another man, that he's under Christ, and that he should boast in that and realize, you know, like what Rusty was saying, all those things are going to fade away.
Well, the mic is coming up. It just dawns on me. This is one of those places you all are, and I went through all these thoughts, and this is one of those places in those times when I think it's really, really helpful and super important to stop and say, wait a minute, what was James looking at? Or his disciples, if they were writing what he was saying. What was he looking at? What was he staring at? What was he faced in? And more importantly, what was his audience faced with? Because this is exactly where it's like, well, how do I think about money and riches and wealth? And that's all helpful and good, but it's like, I need to go over here and what was going on in either 60 or 40 AD when James was writing. And whether that's informative to either of your two comments, I don't know, but that's exactly where I kept going and thought of both of those things. It's like, let me stop for a minute and let me go back to what James was saying.
So if he is writing into a Jewish community where there are those mutually supportive relationships that like-minded people tend to have, you're going to, even in those communities, you're going to have believing and unbelieving Jews, and it's going to start to sort itself out just like it did in Jerusalem. And so there's going to be that breakdown of support for the believers, which will gradually disenfranchise them within the mutually supportive economy. I mean, that's what you're looking at, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What if the rich man is the man in verse 12 who perseveres under trial and finds out after everything he has lost, he goes, wait a minute, God took that all away from me to test me. This I will glory in, and I've kept the faith. So if the Jew leaves Jerusalem under difficult financial circumstances, but arrives in this community out there, wherever, where a dollar's worth more, so to speak, and he's back up here where he's, you know, he's being blessed, he's wealthy, he's a mover and a shaker, and all of a sudden the others figure out, but he's one of them. So he doesn't get that contract, and he doesn't get that good deal, and it starts to disappear. So now he's got a choice. Did God rescue me from persecution just to put me into more persecution? What the heck with God? Or that's the way it goes to someone who believes. But if he perseveres, then he's earned the crown of life.
So that's I hadn't even thought of that. I'll have to think about that.
Okay. It's worth thinking about.
I guess just to play the devil's advocate and also to maybe point to something that might give more support to where you've been taking it just recently. I think verse 12 is significant that he then goes on to say, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. What would be the trial that he would be talking about? It would make a lot of sense if what he has in mind is the trial that you described in 9 and 10 of historically a believing Jew who's experiencing persecution and, because of the severity of it, becoming myopic, where all he can see is this, what is really a transient, momentary experience he finds himself in. And as hard and as difficult as it is, it's not the end of the story. But if he forgets that it's not the end of the story and it's just a moment, then he may bail. He may lose his faith. And that's the biggest tragedy of all. So that, I think it's significant that then he says, look, don't forget that this trial and all that's been taken from you and all that the advantage that you think these people have over you, that's going to fade away. And the contrast then is, look at what's lasting. It's that once you've persevered, there's a reward in store that is truly lasting. So I think that verse 12, the man who perseveres, blessed is he. I think that it makes sense that that's referring to persevering under the trial that must be described in 9 and 10. And the permanence of the reward that's in store for that person is, that image is all the more powerful when contrasted against passing away and the fading away of the riches and the advantage of the moment.
That's it. Thank you.